The main thing that needs to be said about this anthology is that the major force behind it was Carol Reumans, because it was her idea, and even more important than that, she found a publisher for it, and a good publisher, and she was always the driving force throughout, and I was a sort of sous chef, or prep chef even, just something very minor. I think the major thing I did was some last minute proofreading for poets who were, like Tom Pauling, too important to do it themselves. That took place actually during the FA Cup final. So it had the added advantage of diverting my attention from the fact that Chelsea were winning. In terms of the relationship with the earlier anthology, I think it's amazing that everybody in that, I mean, the big exception here is Frank Redpath, of course, who was already quite a senior poet when it came out, was probably younger than I am now, but seemed to me then to be about 300. As always happens when you're young and you're faced with somebody of this sort of vintage. With the exception of Frank, everybody, who is now dead, of course, everybody is still writing, and which is an amazing thing, because, you know, we were all young at that point, and a lot of people stopped writing, but everybody's still writing. And what I think is clear from the anthology is that people are writing better now than they were then. I think the other amazing thing is that, given the way that a lot of people were living in those days, it's amazing that people are still alive, really. A point exemplified by the famous rumoured city fight that took place in an Indian restaurant after the reading. For a fight. I was never good at fighting myself anyway. I did get some curry sauce on me, I think, during that event. Anyway, let's move on to the second half, in which the readers will be, first, in this order, Jenny Ratz, David Wheatley, Carol Reumans, Ian Parks, and Peter Didsbury.
I'm sorry Douglas Dunn isn't here. I would love to have seen him again. He was incredibly supportive to us. I've lived in Hull for 20 years. I don't now, so I've got some claim to be here. I'll read two poems, both of which are with reference to water. One of the reasons that it was just wonderful to see the Humber tonight, to remind me. Okay, I'll start with Embodied Memory. And I composed quite a lot of this while swimming in public baths, I mean, over quite a period of time. I'd sort of sneak back home and write another line. Also, I slept in a cave on the south coast of Crete once, which was an incredibly memorable experience. So it combines swimming with this experience of sleeping in a cave. Every time I step from the medium of this dry breath, from land to water, I am reclothed in the movement of liquid on my skin. My spine elongates, extends the breath to outstretched limbs, fingers, toes, awakens embodied memory. And as I swim, my breathing amplified excites ancient molecules of breath exhaled from remote human ancestors, who fished the tides and swam with long hair rising and falling on the sea, hair dripping as they searched for driftwood, climbed barefoot to their caves, could still hear the crunch of predator on shingle. They watched light changing over the sea, synchronized their breathing with the waves, or sat by firelight, cocooned in slow pulse tidal rhythms, boom of sea caves. And then the other poem is Bird Prince. This is a valediction, if you like. I had really quite a tough time living in Hull. Anyway, that's another story. And I really wanted to write a poem that would lay Hull to rest, if you like. And this is the result. It's quite a short poem. Those of you who are not so familiar with Hull, one of the fantastic things about Hull is the mud flats on the Humber, which have lots and lots of bird prints. I've spent many, many hours painting them, photographing them. For years, we lived on the hard surface of a city, beached on the Humber, and of necessity absorbed the slow mix of fresh and salt tides that draw the margins. We knew the weight of territorial bird prints on silver mudflats. They have become hieroglyphs of memory for all those years we searched for refuge, saturated by the light that bleaches all sense of distance across the estuary. Thank you.
Good evening. I'm very pleased and honoured to be in the book, which I feel should henceforth be known as a Rumen's City. For many years now, I feel I have operated the city of Kingston upon Hull, and I have operated a policy of mutual harassment and abuse, otherwise known as consent, which I at least have got a lot out of. I don't know about it. But I'm also aware, however, that some people, at least in the audience, will have heard me read all too often, and therefore, to dilute the pleasure somewhat, I thought that for the first poem I should read the work of another Irish writer instead, a very excellent writer who lives across the river in Grimsby, a Grimbonian, called Sam Gardner, an avant gardener. And his short poem, A Ring, is a very fine example of his work. I'll begin with that one. A ring. Ring me, she said, years ago, before this ring, this remembering. Soon she was coming round and round, and the polarity was changing from change in the air to bodies on the ground. Bodies only, carefree and freestyle night after night, shocked at not being appalled at the shock of our animality. The feral cries, that cry from the bathroom, your hot is cold. Cold hands in those days couldn't stop her, stopping my blues guitar. No, no, she'd moan, as two no's make one yes, I did, never, expecting ever, hand in hand, to turn to arm in arm, to tongue in cheek. The old fairground is fair game for ghosts, white stars hanging unchanged, while merrily we two go round and round, the light catching her ring. And then called Dry Pool in Old Photographs. And it's very easy to be elegiac about the past, but I wonder, is it possible to be elegiac about something in the present, something which is still going on? Or as a character in Beckett once says, what if the mass for the dead were read over the living? Because, this is based on a photograph of Old Hull 100 years ago or so, but yet I do feel that it is kind of still going on. So this one is called Dry Pool in Old Photographs, and it's not by Sam, it's by me. The man on the corner repeats, at intervals down the street, as though in a trick photographer's loop, hand on hips in fob pockets, ignoring the see-through dog, ghosting along the pub wall behind him, feeding on air, on the ghost of a promise of gristle and bone. Dawn in the brewery yard finds ice on the dung, the dray horse's breath steaming into the lens, the barrels tumble chiming into riverside cellars and are sprung in a week. The dray man's further off judgment day promises the bump and jolt of a cemetery clearance, and only then the vile dust settled at last. The dog and I fall into step, peer through his vitreous ribs, and watch the brickwork rewind decade on decade. Does he want feeding? There aren't shadows enough to sate him. Sharp against my ribs too, the ghost of a torn down future pushes, prods, and will out. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to read a poem which incorporates a poem by Philip Larkin. It's never been published because I don't think any of the publishers that I work with could afford to pay Faber's copyright fees. It's in the form of a glose or a gloss, originally a Spanish form, which I learnt from an American poet, a very good poet called Marilyn Hacker. You take normally just one quatrain, four lines from an original poem, not your own, by somebody else, and then use each one of those four lines as the last line of four consecutive stanzas. That's a strict rule. I didn't follow that rule. Instead, I got the whole poem into this poem, so it's a bit of an odd glose, but it's a poem that I love called The Trees by Philip Larkin. So I'm sure you'll hear those lines of Larkin's weaving or being woven into my lines. It's the one that begins, "The trees are coming into leaf," of course. The trees are coming into leaf, their subterranean purpose clear. This simple contract with the year seems to suspend our disbelief in heaven. Leaves are sap transformed, like something almost being said, but falling into verse instead, with all its whispers. April warmed, the recent buds relax and spread, and it's as if the trees survey their work in wonder and relief. They would be hesitant to say their greenness is a kind of grief. Is it that they are born again, all the leaf children? Leaves possess, like fingers, a unique impress, a tiny future to sustain and then renounce. Do trees grow young and we grow old? No, they die too. They seem immortal, ranged along mad roads, but some will not repeat their yearly trick of looking new, nor reach their century of refrain. Disease, deforestation, beat them hollow. Heartwood's sealed defeat is written down in rings of grain. Yet still the unresting castles thresh, even in autumn. Leaves let go uneasily. They seem to know all the shy selfishness of flesh and claim entitlement to thrive in full-grown thickness every May. Their fate whirls in the groundsman's jet and ends in smoke, dusty or wet, more lost and earthbound every day. Last year is dead, they seem to say. Surely tomorrow will revive. And so this awkward elegy I graft on stanzas best unglossed. Drab climber round a perfect tree must reach the hardest line, the last, and ask, who am I haunting here? No tall, stooped figure breaks the mesh of root-bound bone, no kindly ghost. And what I hear him say, almost, is only what I wish. Of course, do what the living must and press new flight paths through resistant air. You have no quarrel with the dead. In time, We too relax and spread bright leaves. We too, beyond repair, begin afresh, afresh, afresh. Thank you. Thank you.
Lazarus, after I brought you back to life, your short death made you frightened of the sun. I knelt above you, rolled away the stone, uncoiled the silken thread that filled your throat. You never caught my whisper, never saw me when I wept. I called you from the darkness, and you came. You came, expecting birdsong, a new world. Instead, I hauled you up and set you down, dragged you back choking from the brink. The others kept their distance, hid their eyes, refused to hear the flutter of your heart. You stuttered, disappointed that the world was still the same. I acted quickly, breathed into your mouth, astonished as your blue lips turned to red. I learned your secret, kept it to myself, stood silent as you stumbled from the cave. I loved you for returning, for the effort that you'd made. You hated me for doing what I'd done. Very good to be back in Hull. I'll just read two poems, one of mine and one by Frank Redpath. The next one of mine is called Downpour. I mentioned twice in this poem Edward Thomas, who, as most of you will know, is the great early 20th century poet who died in the First World War. Downpour. Not the rain that Edward Thomas heard, beating on the roof of his tin hut, but heavy sheeted, unrelenting rain that drives across the landscape that he loved. To have that sort of rain, you'd need to change the places that it falls upon, unbuild the office blocks and shopping malls, tear down the children's playgrounds, roundabouts, and disinvent the electronic chip. You'd need to clear the motorways, break up the concrete car parks, make them ready for the plough. Let the rain rain unimpeded on the nettles and the curled up ferns. For that, you need to change the hearts and ears of those it rained upon. Make sensitive the taproot and the soil. Not the rain that Edward Thomas heard, the rain that rinses as it falls. This rain has acid in it, and it burns. The next final poem I want to read is by Frank Redpath. Frank befriended me when I was a young, or rather, younger poet living in Hull, and became very important to me during the short time that I knew him when he was alive, and subsequently more important through his work as I've got to know it recently, how it turned out. One I imagine standing on a dark hill with the lights of the city before him, a sign grown into his hand, a directing pressure between his eyes. Not to be fooled with mirrors, thorn cruel maybe, but vital. Soon to be shown a dark world, yes, but brimming, a busy harbour with houses lighted and open and dancing about the trees, and a salesman's twist of the road through, roaring from friend to friend round lovely corners. Was given instead a distorting glass, a guide in broken English, and a sextant, but no sun, only, repeatedly, mourning greyly disgracing him, and further, was denied the ability to dance, the erratic steps, or the shrugging coward's posture, but was left alone on a long road with a diminishing memory of North.
Frank Redpath was indeed a great poet and a very good friend to many of us, including myself. He had the enviable history not only of being a whole poet, but of having written for Beano. So many of the Dennis the Menace that you and I may have written, read in our youths was probably written by Frank, so we'll just get that in. 3 years ago, I was invited to take part in a seminar and reading at Trinity College Dublin. And the unlikely theme was links between Ireland and the north of England, literary links. And while I was pondering what to prepare for this, I realised that I came across an account of the cholera epidemic in the 1840s in Hull, and it was quite clear that many of the Irish immigrants, who may have numbered something like 5 to 10% of the city at the time, were Gaelic speakers, Irish speakers. And a contemporary clergyman talks about them keening in their native language over the grave mouth, which seemed a little bit dismissive. Nighttime burials with flaming torches. So I imagined two people linked by loss, two women who had lost their children, one an Irish woman and one an English Hull resident. And all you need to know really is that it employs two words for supernatural beings. One is the pooka, if I've pronounced that correctly, an Irish devil who will be familiar to anybody who's read at Swim Two Birds, and the bar guest, or bear ghost, who was a Yorkshire monster that was alive in skullcoats into the early 20th century at least. It used to steal children and eat them. This evening I have spent in the Irish woman's room. A fire shared is a fire cheaper. A 12 month since I knew her not at all. Our hearths were crowded then, but now it is fitting that one of them bides cold. A fire shared is a fire cheaper by far. She has enough English now for January tales of our slavering bargeists, which stalk these dark flagged yards intent on the taking of children. She would not have understood a year ago. A year ago, her English was just enough for blessing or cursing, to ask the price of bread or directions to a pump. But now, a fire shared is a fine, instructive tutor. She has enough English now to match my bar guests and goblins with pookas and such like. And I find I have learned what these are from many a night spent sharing and cheapening fire. A 12 month ago, I would not have known the Irish for sorrow, cholera, children, or who stood by me at the same wide grave mouth as we wept after each of our fashions. But now I know these things, which are things I have learned in the school of the ruined hearth, which is held in both our rooms, where a fire shared is the cheapest fire of all. A lot of my poems used to start off with a visual mental image. And for years, rather like Ian's poem, which took 30 years to write, I was haunted by the image of an owl waiting in a pine tree by a pithead for her own of the miner to emerge from the shift. When I finally managed to write it, I think I realised that this was an elegy for the strange kind of semi-rural, semi-urban landscapes, industrial landscapes, which are now gone with the end of the miners' strike and the end of the coal industry. So it's simply called Owl and Miner. The owl alights on his shoulder. All the day shift she's waited patiently there, high in the pine that grows hard by the pithead. Waited, blinking and dreaming, and turning the slow escutcheon of her face. Waited as that which would serve to draw her master back with songs from his deep plutonic shades. Thus it is that he steps from the earth and is greeted. She furls her wings, and as they set off on their mile up the darkening lane towards the low-banked cloud of the clustering houses, he starts to sing to her. I see his white smoke. His breath in the air, he casts as if he would net the voices of ghosts in the empty elder trees. For it is winter now, and his songs are of winter. Wind unparcelled across the keen land. First light snowfall turning black on hedge, warren and iron pool and black road end. Where now the yellow lights begin to come on in twos and threes, haltingly, as if to conjure the stars to commence their stammering nightly speech. And finally, a poem about my great-great-great-grandfather, who was born in 1824 and spent his young years as a matelot in the Royal Navy on the anti-slavery patrols between Africa and Brazil. He later became a Coast Guard in Fleetwood, where he died. And the epigraph for the poem is from the Fleetwood Chronicle for January 1912, and it says, "The deceased for many years was engaged in the suppression of the African slave trade." The poem was sparked off when I looked at some of the things that I'd inherited from him, including a bag of coins, part of his uniform, some of his books. Everything that is mentioned in this poem actually happened either in his career or his contemporaries. Undo the thong that closes the mouth of the bag. Spill William Hobday's coins upon the board. Build from their falling and rocking into silence the boom of sheets and blocks and the gasp of a wind that carries the reek of the swamp in its hair. Hear him sing of home. Hear him tell the tale of the names of the forts of the coasts on imagined bracelets of turquoise and citrine beads. Hear him name the white forts. Summon him now, then down in one the glass of yellow bile that he brings to your side from the quarter deck to hand you. Watch him carry a nigger up from a hold to save her ulcerous feet from the salt-scoured planks, or stand and gaze with him through lidless eyes at a bark, a cable ahead as it jettisons cargo. Summon him here by reciting in a loud voice the poundage of cannon and shot. Oh, summon him here with the names of carronados, with those of comrades, with canister and swivel. Summon him here from Philomel, and that this might come to pass, consume in mine's flame his oak tobacco jar, let flame devour his ribbons and his papers, construct a pyre and arrange that all his pain should tumble to ash with the last of his books about God. And let there be smoke, and let the smoke roll out like mercy to bear the sailor home. Let the smoke caress in the semblance of a breeze the beach by the Irish sea where he paddles at evening. Then let the smoke vanish, except that it should lie in the mouth of his jug as the froth upon the beer he's just been out to fetch, and now, soothed with stern psalms, is carrying home in his old man's dappled hand. Thank you.